thanks for tuning in. I'm Jim Eldringham, and this is my crummy little podcast. Our first guest ever is Matt Lewis. Matt is a senior contributor at the Daily Caller. You can also read his stuff in The Week, The Telegraph, The Daily Beast. You can hear him on his podcast, Matt Lewis in the News. He's on TV a bunch. He's the author of a forthcoming new book, Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Won Elections by Sacrificing Its Ideas and How It Can Reclaim Its Conservative Roots. That comes out in January. You can pre-order it now on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, and you should definitely go do that. Matt Lewis, welcome to the Crummy Little Podcast.
Hey, Jim. Good to be here.
Yeah, and thanks for being so generous with your time when you're clearly the hardest working man. You're like the James Brown of the D.C. pundit circle.
You got to hustle, man. You got to hustle to do this. I mean, because I feel blessed to get to get paid to talk and write about stuff. It's almost unbelievable. But I think the only way you can actually make a living doing it is if you've got a bunch of irons in the fire.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's your biggest iron, but it's certainly one of the more impressive ones is this book that's coming out, Too Dumb to Fail. And I can guess, you don't judge a book by its cover, but I can guess from the title that you're a huge fan of Donald Trump.
No, he's a target. Well, target's the wrong word. He's a villain, I would say, in the book. And it's funny, you start writing a book a couple years out, and you never know, if it's going to be timely or not. By the time the book comes out, will the issue matter? And I mean, sometimes you get lucky, right? And you write a book, and it happens to come out at the right at a good time. And I think the Donald Trump thing is good for me because it's the point of the book is how conservatism was once a very thoughtful philosophy, but how it kind of got dumbed down by demagogues. And here's hoping that Trump is winning in Iowa when the book comes out in January, because it would probably be helpful for me personally, very damaging for the country, but good for me personally.
So in other words, it would be you would be benefiting, like some of the folks that you take to task in your book.
Exactly. We all have perverse incentives. It's things that are individually good for us are collectively bad for conservatism. And so, yeah, I would be actually in the same camp as Donald Trump and others.
Well, that's kind of funny, though. So tell us a little bit about the book. We alluded to the kind of the themes that you tackle, but this is something that you've been thinking about and working on for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing about this phenomenon for years, since the time of the rise of the Tea Party, when I started to notice that conservatives were doing things like playing the victim card and in some cases aping the left and doing things that I used to hate it when liberals did. I started writing things that would be critical of people like, remember Christine O'Donnell. I don't know if people remember her, but she was an early villain. And I would write and say, well, this isn't really conservative. Why are conservatives supporting her reflexively just because she's part of our tribe? I mean, this is a woman who, whatever. I mean, I don't want to keep beating up on her because she's out of the news. But anyway, the Christine O'Donnell phenomenon has morphed into the Donald Trump phenomenon. The good news is that when I first started making this constructive criticism of my friends on the right, I was beaten down and attacked for pointing it out. But I think there's now, I think, a lot more people, a lot more conservatives are open to the idea that some of this stuff is doing more harm than good, and that that conservatism needs you need to sort of point out who the bad actors are in order to sort of protect the actual political philosophy that we know and love.
Now, you're writing this, and obviously your background is in conservative politics, Republican politics, conservative movement. But is this something that cuts both ways? Is this something that's unique to the center right, or is it something that's that's a problem in general with our politics.
Well, I think some of the trends that are hurting conservatives are bipartisan trends. So, for example, changing technology that lowers the barrier of entry and allows anybody to raise money online or tweet online, that has the effect of sort of undermining leadership, and that obviously hits both sides, people on both sides of the aisle. You also have just the loss of trust in institutions that's been happening since Watergate. And obviously that impacts both sides. I do argue that the right has been disproportionately damaged by these trends. The Democrats seem to be much more disciplined, much more organized, and maybe that's because they happen to have the bully pulpit right now, and so they're able to enforce discipline, whereas someone like John Boehner really can't. Nobody's afraid of him, and he doesn't even have earmarks anymore to buy people off. So that could be part of it. Some of it might just be that Democrats are more inclined to a top-down structure where there's sort of central control, you know, whereas Republicans are more interested in individualism and chaos and free markets. And so it could be that conservatives are just less likely to be disciplined and fall in order. It used to be the case that they used to say Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And that's what they said about, you know, when it came to picking a nominee. Obviously, that's no longer true. Republicans are not falling in line.
It's the opposite this time around,
yeah,
it seems.
Yeah. And you know, I don't think it's good to just sort of, just fall in line behind Jeb Bush and coronate him. Like, I don't think that would be a healthy thing either. But there is a danger of this, you know, this becoming just the clown car is the line of this descending into parody. And I don't think anybody wants that either.
You mean seeing the Republican nomination just become a Mad Max style free for all where
right.
Everyone's just kind of,
Game of Thrones, not Game of Thrones. Is that what it is that Obama called it? What's the movie? There's many analogies for what could happen if Donald Trump like actually stays in this race, doesn't drop out and stays in all the way to Iowa, and then maybe drops out and runs as an independent. Not a good thing.
Yeah, but now and this week it's obviously been fashionable to talk about Trump as the front runner. USA Today and Suffolk University had a poll that came out, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, that showed him at 17% and Jeb Bush at 14%. But I mean, that's not really accurate, is it?
By the way, Hunger Games was the movie.
Hunger Games.
The movie I was trying to think of. I think Obama referred to the Republican race as that recently. I'm inclined to believe the polling. I mean, you know, there's a margin of error and there are different polls, but look, consistently for like a month now, as far as I recall, Donald Trump's been polling in like first or second place in national polls and early state polls. And so, you know, I think this is a real thing. He is tapping a nerve, and this is a real problem, actually, I would say.
But do you think, and I don't know enough about his campaign operation. I know that he's hired some people with some street cred, some people who know how to run a campaign, but Madden, obviously, your background is in campaign politics and kind of the gritty, very grassroots nature of this. There's a difference between polling at the top and actually putting up the blocking and tackling that you need to win a campaign, to go and eat at every diner in New Hampshire or visit every county in Iowa. Is Trump going to do all that, or is it just kind of a, you know, something where he can make a splash and then he's gone?
Well, that's a good question. First, we should probably say that, you know, you and I have known each other for like over a decade probably, and we met because I you know, I ran the grassroots department at the Leadership Institute, and you worked there in the what was it called? Youth college campus.
Yeah, campus leadership program, going
CLP.
Going campus to campus.
So anyway, that explains my campaign background, sort of, or at least part of it, with the grassroots experience. You make a valid point. I mean, the notion that Donald Trump is going to trudge around Davenport, Iowa, and you know, go to all of these Lincoln Day dinners and the 99 counties that Charles Grassley goes to every year. I don't see that. I mean, he'll go to Iowa, he'll go to New Hampshire, but I don't see him doing that kind of grunt work. But I just don't know if it matters that much anymore. I mean, for someone like Trump, I mean, I don't think the people who support Trump aren't supporting him because they shook hands with him and because he was a great retail politician. They're supporting him because he's famous and he's larger than life and he says things that nobody else is willing to say. I don't know if he can sustain that, but I don't, you know, there's certain people who, like, they build their credibility kind of on being there, you know, and a lot of times it doesn't work, by the way. I think, was it Dick Gephardt literally moved his family to Iowa and didn't win it? And so there are, you know, but then you've got Rick Santorum, who really did put in the time and energy and effort and just went to, you know, he would go to events and speak where like three people showed up and he just, you know, decided to grind it away and just keep doing it, keep showing up. I don't think Trump's success has ever been built on him showing up. So I don't know anymore if it will matter that much that he's not out there glad handing at every, you know, steak fry.
You know, it seems to me like that the Trump story is just, it's a very easy story to report. It's fun. It's probably, if you're a political reporter, it's kind of fun because you don't know what he's going to say. You don't know what he's going to do. You don't know who he's going to call out and how he's going to do it. How complicit is the media? You know, going back to the original theme of kind of the dumbing down of our politics, how much is the media complicit in this? And not just new media, which you mentioned, but the old standards, the old traditional media.
Right. Well, and you make a good point there that one of the problems that I outline in the book that is the media. I mean, you know, and not just social media, but, you know, say like talk radio, 24-hour news coverage changes everything. And, you know, there's a good side to it, but I think there's a downside to it as well. So I used to get ticked off because, you know, the press would cover someone like Donald Trump, and I thought they were giving him too much attention and too much oxygen, and he didn't warrant it because he wasn't really going to run. So for a long time, including the entire 2012 cycle, I thought it was, you know, irresponsible of the press to cover Trump the way they did and to cover the birther stuff. But now I think it's newsworthy. He really is running for president. And by the way, interestingly, Huffington Post has decided all of their Trump coverage will be on the entertainment section. I'm not joking. It's a real thing. Unless I've been had. But I just saw Michael Calderon, who's the HuffPost media reporter, tweeted that out. So I believe it to be true. I think it's newsworthy. I think it's legitimate. I mean, this is a guy who really is running for president. He really has filed his financial disclosure forms, and he really had an announcement, and he's polling in like second place in a lot of polls and first in some. So I think now he's legitimate to cover, and you know, it's fun and it's good ratings and it gets clicks, but I think also it's a valid story.
Yeah, that's probably why we've talked so much about it, too. It's selfish. We're just part of the problem, Matt.
Well, we have perverse incentives, and it's a moral hazard here as well.
So you know, who else are the, you mentioned Trump, you talked a little bit about new media, old media, who are the other villains that are bringing down our democracy as we know it?
Well, I don't think, I think Trump is sort of, you know, in a class by himself, but I do think there are people, who are running in the primary, who are sort of pandering to the base and kind of an angry populism. Scott Walker is a classic example of somebody that I, you know, kind of had high hopes for. You know, very good governor of Wisconsin, elected or like won 3 elections in 4 years, took on the unions. But he was someone that you had a sense could be a uniter, not a divider, at least on the right, that he could kind of be an acceptable choice for establishment, mainstream conservatives, and also the kind of Tea Party grassroots base. And rather than kind of rise to the occasion and accept that role as kind of a peacemaker, it really seems like he's doubled down on trying to win Iowa, which involves flip-flopping on all sorts of issues, including immigration, and sort of playing to the angry, frustrated populist base. And so, again, it's incentives. You know, for some reason, Iowa's first. Iowa's full to win the Iowa caucuses. You know, you have to win, you know, working class, white, evangelical, very conservative voters, the kind of people who are willing to not just vote in a primary, but to like go spend a day or an evening caucusing. And that's his strategy. And that is, I think, unfortunately driven his messaging, and he's had to change his positions. And I think that's unfortunate. There are other bad actors. I think there are plenty of people, you know, conservative people in the media who sell books and get clicks by pandering to angry, frustrated people. But collectively, the things they write, the things they say, I think will damage the conservative and Republican brand. So, you know, the book's called Too Dumb to Fail. And obviously, it pays homage to the Too Big to Fail book by Andrew Ross Sorkin. And there really are similarities. You know, in the case of Too Big to Fail, you basically had these financial institutions that were, you know, taking risks, knowing that they couldn't fail, that they would be bailed out. And I think there's sort of a parallel that's happening right now on the right, where you have there are these perverse incentives for individual actors to say things that benefit them individually, but collectively tarnishes the brand. And simultaneously, we now have an environment where there are no leaders, there are no adults, nobody has the moral authority to call them out, and nobody, you know, in the old days, you know, if there was a kid making a lot of noise on a street, some old guy would tell him to shut up and sit down. And if there was a member of Congress who was saying dumb stuff, he'd be pulled aside by the majority leader, the speaker, and he'd be informed that if he wants to get that bridge in his town, that he would, you know, shut up and quit making a fuss. And there's a downside to that. There's certainly a downside to having elites in smoke-filled back rooms calling the shots. But the opposite extreme of that is having every, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry write his own foreign policy, decide what to say publicly, and you end up having utter chaos. And that's basically where we're at.
Now, you mentioned risk. That's kind of an interesting point. You know, and we saw it work poorly in financial institutions where they took a lot, as you mentioned, they took a lot of risk knowing that there's someone here to bail us out. At the same time, in politics, you see a blending of of the types of candidates that we get. You mentioned that, you know, candidates will kind of will adapt their messages for Iowa. You know, you see a guy like Marco Rubio is a big leader on immigration and the last, you know, congressional session trying to walk that back a little bit. You see everyone kind of coming back to guys that they know, like Jeb Bush and Donald Trump, where they're familiar names, but maybe not understanding the issues behind them. Do you feel like we're getting leaders who are, well, not leaders, politicians who are less risk averse because of all this?
I think the problem is that that doing stupid things pays off for them individually. And so it's not really risky. There's this silly story, and it might get pulled out before my book's published, but I have a little, you know, vignette in there or whatever about the Simpsons episode where this new guy named Grimey starts working at the power plant. And
it's classic.
Yeah. It's a classic episode. And like, he's just can't believe that Homer Simpson's a safety inspector and Homer's been to space and Homer's got a wife and a house and kids. And like,
Grimey lives above a bowling alley and below another bowling alley.
And like, no matter what Homer does, it always works out for him. Like, Grimey tries to trap Homer by entering him into this build a power plant contest for little kids, like build a model power plant. And Homer builds one, and he ends up winning the contest. And it's supposed to make Homer look stupid that he won a kid's contest, but instead, like, everyone thinks it's awesome, and Mr. Burns, like, congratulates him. And basically, it's one of those things where, like, you just keep doing stupid things and you keep getting rewarded for it. And I think, like, for a long time, that's kind of what's happened with conservatives. But eventually that won't work, right? So, like, as the public becomes, you know, more diverse demographically, and – I mean, right now, basically Republicans rely on winning by virtue of working-class whites who are non-college educated, who live in rural areas. And as sad as it may be, that is a demographic that will not continue to deliver the presidency, you know, indefinitely.
Right. The shrinking percentage of the voting population.
And so, you know, now you're already losing the African-American vote at about a 95%, you know, clip or whatever. So maybe you need to win some urbanites or Hispanics. I mean, you know, whatever. You can't lose these other groups at that rate. You know, single women, let's say. That they're a pretty rough demographic for Republicans too, as a rule. And so basically, eventually, the Homer Simpson shtick will not work, and then what do you do? And I do fear, you know, it's possible that the Republican Party could essentially become a party that cannot win general elections, cannot win the presidency, that it can win midterms and it could control the House and the Senate, maybe even, but never win another presidency, never win the popular vote. Keep in mind, people don't realize the Republicans have lost the popular vote in 5 out of the last 6 presidential elections, which is pretty astonishing if you think of it, and then think that there are a lot of conservatives who are arguing, hey, just keep doing what we've been doing. Things are great.
That's, yeah, because it's, you know, to keep the analogy going, you know, Homer Simpson acts like a buffoon and everything works out. And Grimey comes along and tries to do the same thing and he gets electrocuted.
Yes.
So eventually something has to chill. Someone has to step in and not.
Clearly,
and not
clearly, you've seen this episode.
I love this episode. I've
The best part, of course, is that he never wanted to be called grimy. And right. And then at the end, the Reverend delivering his eulogy, he says, I think he called him
Grimes.
Grimy
to his friends.
And his headstone had Grimy, like his name was like Grimy in quotes, I think. Jim Grimy Altringham or whatever it was. And then Homer like falls asleep during the eulogy and everybody thinks it's hilarious, you know? That I can't believe the show's still on, but what an amazing show that was.
Yeah, that's as long as you can, one of the highlights of the first, you know, 10 or 12 years of it, which is really the only part of The Simpsons worth watching. Well, Matt, I would ask you how the Republican Party and the conservative movement avoids becoming grimy. But looking at the title of your book, which, by the way, are you getting paid by the word in the subtitle? Mm-hmm. Is that how this works?
Well, the title itself is short. But yes. The subtitle is very long.
The Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Won Elections by Sacrificing Ideas and How It Can Reclaim Its Conservative Roots, which is good because, I think after the 2012 election, you were one of the first people, and I think you may have coined the phrase modernize, not moderate.
Yeah. That's me.
As kind of the path forward. And I would ask you to explain that, except based on the title of your book, it looks like it's in there, and we can't give away the story.
Yeah, well, we won't give away the story. I will just say that I'm not advocating becoming liberal. Like, that's not what I'm saying. It's not become more liberal so you can win elections. It's I think conservatism is a good and serious philosophy. I'm going to do the most good for the most Americans. But I think, it has to be presented in a way that appeals to a 21st century America. And think of the guy who orders an Uber on his smartphone and then, orders baseball tickets and on his way, on StubHub, and then on his way to the game, he's managing his stock portfolio on his smartphone. That guy ought to be a conservative, as far as I'm concerned. But he's not going to be if, in his head, when he thinks of what does a Republican look like, it's a caricature of a Southerner or something, of a George W. Bush, let's say. So that's essentially where I am on it. And, the question is, like, do you honestly believe that you can just keep doing what you've been doing and get different results? Or do you believe that, every once in a while it's important to accept reality and to think about adjusting conservatism without abandoning its fundamental ideas and values? But to make it appeal in the 21st century. And political parties do this. This has to be done. The Democratic Party had to do this. And, sometimes parties go away if they don't adapt. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Well, the book is, as I said, Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Won Elections by Sacrificing Its Ideas and How It Can Reclaim Its Conservative Roots. You can pre-order it on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. Is that right?
Yes, wherever you buy your fine books.
Wherever fine books are sold online, you can go and pre-order your copy. And in the meantime, you can keep checking out Matt Lewis at The Daily Caller, The Week, The Telegraph, The Daily Beast, on his podcast, Matt Lewis and the News. And turn on your TV, and he may be staring back at you,
like Mr. Jones, right?
But not in a creepy
way.
When
I look at the television, I want to see me staring right back at me.
That's and you get to
sometimes,
and everyone else can have you staring right back at them. Matt Lewis, thank you for being so generous with your time and kicking off the Crummy Little Podcast.
All right, Jim. Thank you, and good luck on the Crummy Little Podcast.
You can follow the podcast at www.crummylittlepodcast.com, and you, of course, follow me on Twitter at Jim Altringham. Thanks again. See you next week.